Welcome to episode 18 of Indestructible, Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborrada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborrada and I'm based in Sydney, Australia. If you like the content of this podcast, you may want to consider supporting us on Patreon. All of our patrons are now receiving a small selection of references to articles, podcasts, and books, which deal with some of the key topics discussed in each episode. Another way you can support us is by simply sharing this episode and letting your friends know about the podcast. You will find us on Spotify under the name Alborrada, which is spelled A-L-B-O-R-A-D-A, and on Twitter and Facebook under Indestructible Podcast. On Instagram, you will find us under the title Indestructible Pod. On December 7, 2022, using Article 134, Peru's democratically elected President Pedro Castillo attempted to close Congress due to their constant obstructionism towards his center-left administration. Shortly afterwards, Peru witnessed a soft coup by the country's right-wing controlled Congress as Castillo was detained by police and his own security detail as he attempted to make his way to the Mexican embassy, possibly to ask for political asylum as his own family later requested. With Vice President Dina Boluarte declared the country's new president, U.S. Ambassador to Peru Lisa Kenna recognized the new regime and gave it $8 million under the guise of eradicating coca leaf production, despite the fact that the country's indigenous peoples have been growing and using coca leaves for thousands of years. A former rural school teacher and union leader who organized massive strikes for better teachers' pay and conditions in education, Castillo's government was sabotaged by Congress from day one once he won the 2021 presidential election. There, Castillo's biggest opponent was the right-wing politician Keiko Fujimori, daughter of the ex-dictator Alberto Fujimori, who ruled Peru from 1990 to 2000 and is currently serving a 25-year prison sentence for serious human rights violations. Now, as reported in the New York Times on January 18th, 50 Peruvians have lost their lives as they demand Castillo be released from prison and, amongst other requests, would like to see new elections held as the country is currently under a state of emergency as the right to free movement and assembly has been suspended. In order to get a better understanding of these issues, I spoke to Zoe Alexandra, who was recently in Peru covering the demonstrations against Boluarte. Zoe is a journalist and co-editor of People's Dispatch. She covers social movements and leftist politics in Latin America and the Caribbean. I now leave you with Zoe Alexandra. So, Zoe, before we discuss the current crisis in Peru and its background, I'm interested in knowing how long you were in Peru and what attracted you, I guess, to its politics and just Latin American politics in general.
Definitely. Well, I was really only in Peru for a week. We were seeing what was happening with the coup and predominantly with the narrative that we were seeing from a lot of mainstream media on the continent within Latin America, but also outside of Latin America. And we felt it was very necessary to actually talk to people on the ground who were mobilizing, who were withstanding such, you know, horrific repression, which I know we're gonna talk about later, to be able to show their voices and shine lights on it, because it was being very obscured in all of the coverage that was happening. So we felt it was very important from People's Dispatch and to really go there and actually do what a lot of the mainstream media refused to do in this context. So that's kind of where we went. And I mean, personally, I've been living in and out of Latin America for the past decade now. But originally started, I guess, because I was doing research on Canadian mining companies in Latin America. So I think the thread of imperialist interests in the region and kind of inhibiting and hindering the region's full development and potential is something that's always really interest me and motivated me to continue studying, continue learning, and of course, all of the reporting. I try to approach it with that kind of perspective because living in the global north and especially in the United States, the role that our government, our companies that are based here plays in really hindering democratic development, economic development, and people's ability to fully achieve their national dreams and their and the people's development is directly because of the interests of this country. So that's a bit about my background.
Mm-hmm. Now, on December 7th, 2022, Pedro Castillo, the democratically elected president of Peru, attempted to temporarily close the Congress, controlled by the political hard right, after it failed to impeach him for a third time. A few hours later, apparently on his way to the Mexican embassy, Castillo was detained by his own bodyguards and local police in Lima. By December 8th, after the vice president, Dina Boluarte, was sworn in as president, the U.S. State Department declared that, and I quote, "The United States welcomes President Boluarte and hopes to work with her administration to achieve a more democratic, prosperous, and secure region," end quote. From your perspective, what happened on December 7th in Lima, Peru?
Well, it's a very, it's a one of those days that really condenses things that have been happening over a year, over the past several years, the whole political system in Peru kind of in a nutshell in that one day. And I think a lot of the mainstream media narrative that we had so much criticisms of is that it's really just focusing on this one day, but I think not looking at the process that leads up to this day. So essentially on this day, after a year and a half of being president, Pedro Castillo faces his third impeachment motion. There had been two others before, but not only that, he had been faced with investigations from the attorney general. The media in Peru was essentially on a constant attack against him, against his family members, against members of his cabinet. The Congress consistently refused to approve his cabinet that he would attempt to put forward to approve any of the legislation that he was trying to implement. And so what happens on December 7th is that once again, he's facing an impeachment motion. And there's really, they had also, the members of the Congress had also changed the law so that they needed less votes in order to pass the impeachment motion. It's still unclear what exactly led Pedro Castillo to take this move. Did he think that the measure was going to pass this time and he was trying to avoid it? He'd already made a lot of different attempts to kind of calm down the right-wing opposition, resist these impeachment motions, but it was kind of the last straw. And so for some reason, we don't really know this reason yet, he decides to take this move. He announces it on national TV, but none of that actually comes to fruition. And the right-wing Congress, which had just been dissolved by his order, meets and they decide to impeach him, and he's arrested, as you mentioned. But it's important to contextualize all of that, what happens that day. And it's really, as I said, the result of this whole process of once he's elected in June, first of all, for 1 month, he's not even allowed, these electoral results are not certified. Keiko Fujimori, who is his opponent in the second round of these elections, resisted and used every single possible measure, the courts, questioning the results in all of these different municipalities and refusing to accept the results. So when he's actually sworn in July, it's already coming after 1 month of instability in the country, a moment of creating insecurity, of people not really trusting what happens with these electoral results because of what the right wing is doing, how the media is reporting on it. And so that's the kind of situation that he comes into. And then, of course, as I said, from there, he's investigated for corruption. Members of his party are investigated for corruption. He's attacked constantly. This pro-people policies that he had wanted to implement became very challenging because he was met with so much resistance, attacks coming against every single person. So this is, I think, what is the context that's necessary to understand maybe the confusing events that would happen on December 7th. And then, of course, this helps us understand why this coup has been so widely rejected, above all by the working people in Peru.
Now, since Castillo was overthrown, Peru has been gripped by popular demonstrations. I was following your comments on Twitter. You published an excellent article with the People's Dispatch as well. And some of the very harsh state repression of protesters, approximately 30 of which have now been killed by state forces. As someone who was on the ground in Peru, what did you witness, and what are some of the key demands, I guess, of the protesters?
Well, I'll start with the demands. The demands are very diverse in terms of what people are saying on the streets, different political parties, trade unions, but I think they can be synthesized into four key demands. One is for the immediate resignation of Dina Boluarte, who people believe that her presidency is illegitimate. She was sworn in under kind of illegal and unconstitutional grounds. So they're calling for her immediate resignation, the dissolution of the right-wing controlled Congress, which has for so long kind of put forward these coup measures, not only the day of December 7th, but over the whole time that Pedro Castillo was president. They're calling for a constituent assembly to be held, for a new constitution to be drafted for the country. This is a longstanding demand that existed before Pedro Castillo was one of the campaign promises. And actually on December 7th, he announced that he would be installing a constituent assembly. So this is a key demand, and it really represents the kind of larger social, economic, and political crises facing facing Peru. And the final one is also, of course, for the very important immediate release and restitution of Pedro Castillo. He's still, 1 month later, exactly to this day, he still remains in prison, accused of a host of different charges. His detention was illegal, and the Congress actually voted to remove his immunity that he would have as president. So once again, going to every single length possible to basically make an example of him and say that you can't be president, you can't try to change anything in this system, it's not going to work. And if you do try, this is what's going to happen to you. You're going to be put in prison. So they're calling for his immediate release, and many are calling for his restitution as constitutional president of Peru. Beyond that, there are many other demands. One of the other popular demands was for calling for early elections. And this was actually responded to. Dina Boluarte decided to hold elections early in April 2024. Many people are unhappy with this. They wanted immediate elections, elections to happen these coming months. So this demand also stands, that even these April 2024 elections be brought forward to 2023. So that's something to also watch out for. And really, I think the sense on the streets, I was there at a moment just a day after very, very brutal repression happened in places across the country, massacres, in Ayacucho, which I visited. 10 people were killed in one day by the army, who opened fire on the protests. In Lima as well, there's been a huge amount of repression. A lot of people from the countryside, from the southern regions of Peru, have actually come to the capital to protest, to stand in front of the bodies of power that have been carrying forward these anti-democratic moves, and to say, we won't stand for this. So many people are in Lima, and they have been met with very, very brutal repression on December 16th, the first day, 17th, which was the first day I was actually in Peru. The office of the Peasant Federation of Peru, CCP, was raided by the police, and about 28 people had been held, essentially detained for over 12 hours in that day. And they're facing charges of terrorism. And many of their defenders, the human rights defenders, lawyers, have said that during this raid, police actually came in and put planted evidence in the place that they were staying in order to make sure that there would be a conviction. So all of these different things are happening. There continue to be ongoing criminalization of people who are participating. The use of allegedly non-lethal weapons against protesters, but also the use of actually lethal weapons against protesters. So it continues to be a very, very difficult situation. But in spite of all of this, in spite of the repression, the demand for this new constitution, and really what this means is the demand for a new system for the people, a new system where people can be can actually have access to rights, have access to healthcare, education, and housing. This demand is really just driving people to go on the streets, despite all of the fear, despite all of the harassment and the stigmatization by the media. And I think that's why we can see surprising amounts of mobilization across the country.
Now, having won the June 2021 presidential election by a margin of just 44,000 votes out of nearly 19 million cast, Pedro Castillo, a former rural school teacher and union leader, only narrowly defeated his hard right opponent, Keiko Fujimori, daughter of the ex-dictator Alberto Fujimori. While Castillo's leftist Free Party was the largest in the country's incoming Congress with 37 seats, his new government still faced a hostile right-wing majority headed by 24 members of Fujimori's Popular Force, the second largest party. Could you tell us a little bit more about Keiko Fujimori, the hard-right Congress that repeatedly tried to impeach Castillo, and I guess their connection to the US-backed Fujimori dictatorship, which ruled Peru from 1990 to the year 2000?
Well, it's a very complicated bunch, all of those different people, both the Popular Force Party, the Fujimori family. I guess the word that I would use to describe all of these kind of different groups is criminal. The Fujimori family, of course, Alberto Fujimori, who was the dictator in Peru, was the architect of so many different crimes against humanity, the forced sterilization of indigenous women, the extremely brutal campaign against the insurgent groups, which saw tens of thousands of peasants and indigenous people, innocent civilians being killed in the name of fighting the insurgency. He also, of course, was the architect of the 1993 Constitution, which for many, of course, with this demand for the new constitution to be written, is the constitution that essentially solidifies, institutionalizes neoliberalism, the exclusion of the masses of Peru from politics, from the ability to make decisions about their lives, establishment of the one body of legislation. And Alberto Fujimori, of course, he attempted to flee. He was arrested and is not a character that actually is just now arrested and has no participation in politics or does not make any impact. His daughters and sons, Keiko Fujimori, Kenji Fujimori, have had very, very active participation in politics and have been at the center of new scandals and new crimes committed in similar ways, in taking advantage of this position of power to exploit the resources of the Peruvian people for their own personal gain. So both Keiko and Kenji have been at the center of huge, huge corruption scandals in the country. Kenji Fujimori was actually kicked out of the Popular Force Party after evidence came out that he essentially tried to buy votes in order to get his father out of prison, Alberto Fujimori. Keiko has also been involved in a lot of different corruption schemes. And it's interesting because while one of the major criticisms that the right wing will lodge against Pedro Castillo and his party is that they're criminals, that they're terrorists, that they're corrupt and they do X, Y, Z, actually the people who have been tried and convicted of corruption, of money laundering, of abuse of power, are actually the Fujimori family and all that they and all of the people that kind of surround them and their right-wing party. And of course, many of them have this elected official immunity, which prevents them from going to prison and in some cases facing trial. Many people thought that once Keiko Fujimori was defeated in the presidential elections that she would be going to prison immediately. Of course, this hasn't happened. The judiciary is also controlled by the right wing, but there's so much evidence out there that shows how parties like Popular Force, politicians like Keiko Fujimori, Kenji Fujimori, sons and daughters really of the dictatorship have continued to kind of perpetuate this style of politics. And of course, they don't want someone in power, even though Pedro Castillo was not able to really carry forward so many of the things he wanted to, even someone who's willing to question the immunity that members of parliament have, that's willing to say that there shouldn't be poor people in a rich country. This, even that is a threat to their style of politics, is a threat to the way that they do business, which is really to have these elected positions and do what they want with the riches of the Peruvian people. So I think that really speaks to it, the fact that even though they love to say that Pedro Castillo was useless, that he did nothing, even then they couldn't tolerate him being president.
Now, Castillo's short-lived government was often accused of corruption, and you've sort of talked about that, and of having betrayed its own leftist agenda, which has stood to win the 2021 presidential election. I guess, are there any, I'm interested in knowing, are there any merits to these claims, in particular of him betraying his leftist agenda, or is it a case of basically Congress blocking any progressive policies that he tried to carry out?
So with regards, for example, to the corruption allegations, it's interesting because after having served as an elected official for maybe a week, he was already accused of abuse of power and corruption. And again, there's really no evidence to back these claims up. And it just seems like a standard charge sheet that they're going to press on every single leftist who's ever elected. So with regards to the corruption allegations, it clearly was a collusion between the Attorney General's office, the media, to just create instability, to create chaos, to create distrust. I mean, there's many strong supporters of Pedro Castillo, but of course others are going to be swayed by this constant media propaganda. Once you have an investigation opened up into someone, even though they're innocent until proven guilty, this of course creates a certain narrative. So with regards to his kind of loyalty to his positions and his position with regards to the party, et cetera, I think it, again, it has to be really taken in the context of how the country's operating, of the attacks on the left wing, of this constant destabilization that I've been mentioning, because it's impossible to really analyze it without this lens, without having this macro perspective. So yes, if you look, there were many times where Pedro Castillo kind of distanced himself from leftist positions, maybe of his maybe former promises. There was, for example, a split with Peru Libre, which was the party that he was elected with. But again, it has to be seen in the context of, for example, every single minister that he proposed from a more leftist tradition became the target of media slander, of media campaigns. This also made him a target. I spoke to the niece of Pedro Castillo, and she said every Sunday they sat around and they wondered, okay, what is the press going to think of tomorrow? Every week it's something new, whether it's who he picks to go as the foreign minister or whether he wears his sombrero. All of these things are kind of target for scrutiny and criticism by the media. And then, I mean, if you look at some of the things he did try to implement, he did pass the agrarian reform, which is extremely important in a country that has a very, very large rural population, which is also one of the most kind of economically impoverished and unequal to those who live in the capital city in terms of their access to resources, in the terms of their access to education, healthcare, etc. So actually, making policies for this population is extremely important. His, for example, response to the oil spill that happened off of the coast of Peru because of the company Repsol from Spain was also extremely important. He stood up to a very, very large and powerful and wealthy Spanish multinational oil company and demanded reparations. It's important to point out that to this day, the Spanish oil company has refused to pay for the damages, for all of the, essentially the slaughter of a lot of the killing of a lot of animals because of this oil spill. And other positions he took, he attempted to pass a electricity subsidy bill. So many different things. And of course, this constituent assembly, which kind of at the end of his time, he had been proposing throughout his presidency. And then the last day of his presidency, this was one of his key proposals as well. And so, yes, I think that in some ways you can say, okay, yes, he in some ways distanced himself from the party, from maybe the movements, but it is in this context of attacks, of divisions within the left, of the left getting attacked. And it's also in a historical context, the fact that the Peruvian left has suffered so much criminalization, so many attacks over the years. And it's a country where the right wing is very, very strong and has really worked to divide, to create huge obstacles for the left to be able to unite. And so all of this has to be kind of taken into account when thinking about what happened. And I think it was a really uphill battle for him in any case, in a context where a country with not very strong united social movements, not a strong united force on the streets to defend him. We didn't see massive protests saying hands off Pedro Castillo. Of course there were protests, but in order for a country to really face a right wing that's been in power for so long and that has all of the tools of power at its disposal, except the executive, you need more than just one president to really survive.
Now, throughout the Americas, the United States, Brazil, and Chile have welcomed the new regime in Lima, while Mexico, Bolivia, Colombia, Venezuela, and Argentina have harshly condemned it. The majority of the countries in Latin America have refused to recognize Boluarte's government. What is your take on how political developments are playing out, I guess, at a regional and international level?
I think the support that Pedro Castillo has received from Gustavo Petro, from Andrés Manuel López Obrador, once again, the Mexican government really, really being a lifeline. Pedro Castillo's family is currently in Mexico. I think this is fundamental. If this had happened 5 years ago when the region was dominated by right-wing governments, and we see, for example, the Lima Group existing, that maybe it would have been, the events would have happened differently. But I think that the pressure that the regional leaders are putting on this government is evident, because, for example, right now, Evo Morales is essentially being declared a persona non grata. Dina Boluarte announced that they were evaluating with immigration to see if he would be allowed in the country. Of course, the Mexican ambassador was kicked out of the country. These moves and these decisions are a clear result of them feeling the political pressure. And that is so important, because otherwise they could just be doing what they want. But because of the constant international tension on the violence that they're carrying out about the civilians, they've actually had to be a lot more careful. And for example, on January 4th, people were back on the streets, and in some regions of the country, there is an indefinite national strike. And as of now, I think, of course, there was very, very strong violence against protesters, even still in Lima, many have been arrested, but I think they are forced to show a little bit of restraint because they know that they can't get away with it. The Inter-American Human Rights Commission already visited Peru and did visits of many regions where there was a lot of violence. So I think the government is seeing that it actually has to kind of stand in line a certain amount because of this pressure. And it's really been incredible to see what a united region does, what pressure will put on other governments that are blatantly violating the rights of its population. And so the role of Andrés Manuel in giving asylum to Pedro Castillo's family, Gustavo Petro denouncing these actions of the right-wing Congress is fundamental.
Now, in the last 6 years, Peru has had 7 presidents, with several resigning after being accused of corruption. If my memory serves me correctly, I think even one president committed suicide. How do you think things will play out in the future, given that there appears to be a widespread rejection of Castillo's removal?
Well, I think the demand of a constituent assembly really speaks to the fact that what the people want is not just a simple change of office. They don't see real change happening just by voting one more time, electing a new president, electing a new Congress. They know that the only way to prevent coups like this from happening in the future, to actually gain some level of political stability in the country, is through rewriting the constitution. And I think the examples that we see in other countries, for example, in Venezuela, the constituent process there, other countries in the region that have kind of reconceptualized what it means, what the state means, what people's participation in politics means. Of course, the Venezuelan example is one that's tremendous, and building different bodies that see local level participation. I think that's really kind of the way forward. People aren't going to be content by just going to the polls and doing what they do now it's even been every 4 years. So I think this is the way forward, and that's why people continue to be on the streets and continue to raise this demand, in that even if elections happen 2024, if they don't have a constituent assembly, people are going to continue to be on the streets in Peru, because it's not only their political participation that's really restricted and limited with the current system, but for example, their mineral wealth in the country, the possibility for them to have access to education, so many of the fundamental human rights that I've already mentioned, this is all built into the infrastructure of the constitution, and they want to see a change. They don't want just to go to the polls. And so I think this is the real crucial aspect. There will continue to be instability in the country. There will continue to be a kind of corrupt politics of the right wing, of using the instruments of power, of using the media. The media in Peru is definitely one of the strongest instruments that the right wing has been yielding to kind of push forward their project. All of these things have to be contemplated in this process, which is really about rewriting society, creating a new society that's more just, that's more equal, and that where people actually have a say in deciding what happens.
Zoe Alexandra, internationalist, popular communicator, who works with People's Dispatch. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us here at Indestructible, Indestructible Podcast, an Alborada podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible. Indestructible. Once again, I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon, which you can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any comments on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on the Alborada website. We'll be back soon with episode 19, but until then, goodbye and stay safe. Indestructible.